The CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, RDO, Spotify, secondary ticketing, and Zayn Malik. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. And you might notice from our intro that probably the biggest story in music this week is not one of the ones that we're going to discuss in detail. Although I feel we should acknowledge the attacks in Paris last Friday, and particularly from a music perspective at the Eagles of Death metal gig at the Bataclan, where a lot of people died. And we didn't feel the tone of this podcast led for it to be appropriate for us to discuss.
A horrible incident that we have been covering on the website and in the CMU Daily, and we will continue to do so as other updates occur. And also, obviously, it initiated a debate about security measures in live music venues and things like that. So, yeah, not really appropriate, I think, for us to talk on the podcast this week. But we are covering it online, so keep an eye on that.
In more conventional industry news now, the biggest story on that side was that Pandora has bought bits of RDO.
Yes. So I suppose, yeah, in terms of music business, straight industry news, that is the biggest story this week. And I think that is a topic that is more than
I think we can discuss that, yeah.
For us to discuss on the podcast. Yeah, so basically, RDO is no more.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever said this on the podcast, but certainly between us, we've definitely for quite a while been going, I wonder when RDO is going to get sold.
Yes.
And I think we assumed RDO would get sold as a going concern or be sort of more completely merged into another service.
Yes.
So whereas actually Pandora is stripping it of the bits it wants and leaving most of it behind.
Into a big pile of bankruptcy mess.
Yes.
So yeah, we've been talking about RDO in that context in recent months of, well, we heard a rumour that they were up for sale a while ago, so we knew that it was being shopped around. I suppose there was the question of, well, who would buy it? Although you were sort of thinking, I don't know, is there a big tech company or a big media company who still wants a streaming service who might take it on? The fact that RDO has, in essence, been wound down is not so surprising. The fact that it is going into bankruptcy almost immediately and that Pandora are taking the assets is more interesting. I suppose, you know, backtrack with RDO. I think since on-demand streaming started to gain momentum, whenever that was, when was that? Was it the 19th of July 2012? Was that when on-demand streaming started to really gain momentum? Or was it 2011?
I was going to say 2011.
2011. RDO, I think, was often seen as the third of the on-demand streaming services. So obviously Pandora, which is central to this story, is different because it's a personalised radio service and also it's only really available in the US, Australia and New Zealand as well. But it's not a service that has had very much attention over here. Way back, I suppose it did, because in the early days you could access it over here unofficially. But it's never been seen as a serious streaming service in the UK. And so over here and in Europe, you had Spotify and Deezer that entered the market at pretty much the same time. Actually, Deezer's slightly ahead of Spotify, if I get my timeline right. I think I'm right in saying that.
Yeah.
So Spotify and Deezer appeared at the same time. Spotify quite quickly got a head start on Deezer in terms of rolling out across Europe and getting users signed up.
Yeah.
And then RDO showed up.
Yeah, and I think when RDO launched, initially, I think it was certainly seen as a potential contender to Spotify. And Spotify at that point was not so far ahead of everyone else like it is now. And I think people definitely thought, well, this little plucky startup, actually is founded by someone who founded eBay, so it's not so much
a plucky startup,
there's money behind it. Which also, I guess, prompted people to go, this definitely has a chance to kind of overtake Spotify and maybe become the big thing. And it prized kind of design over, not over functionality, because it had the functionality as well. I mean, it was all these streaming services are similar in a lot of ways, and RDO sort of differentiated itself by having nicer design and everything. People have often criticised Spotify of looking like a spreadsheet, and RDO
certainly
tried to combat that. In fact, this week, I don't know if this has ever been a comparison before. I'd certainly not really noticed it, but this week I noticed a lot of people saying RDO was like Mac to Spotify's PC, and until recently, a PC was the thing, you know, functionality beat out design. PCs are still way more popular than Macs, really, although Macs obviously had a big boost.
Of course, the problem with that comparison is that actually Spotify was built to look quite like iTunes. because back in the early days, that's what people were familiar with. But you're right, RDO always had a swisher design, and Spotify has improved. But in the early days, Spotify didn't seem to do anything to their interface for a number of years.
And RDO launched with a much better app than Spotify straight off. I mean, there was a point when I had accounts on both, and there was a point where I think, maybe this is what a lot of people did, is I was using RDO going, yeah, this is good. I might switch over to this. And then just never did.
Never quite got round to it.
So I'm still with Spotify.
So you're still on Spotify. So it sort of, for all of those reasons, because it had a known founder who had a lot of money, because it was quite swish, and it seemed to launch with a little bit of a fanfare. It very quickly was seen as being the third, and obviously based out of the US, whereas both Deezer and Spotify originate in Europe. Actually, things like Wimp that became Tidal was probably ahead. Mm. We always forget about Rhapsody / Napster, which reinvented itself as a streaming service a number of years back now, and it was probably always ahead. Nevertheless, you tended to think, it goes Spotify, then it goes Deezer, and then it goes RDO.
RDO always suspiciously quiet on its user numbers.
Indeed. And so after things started to gain momentum, when did we say it was? The 4th of May 2011.
Yeah.
When things started to gain momentum. Spotify then started this, putting out once a year and then every 6 months their stat brags, where they put out a press release or they'd hold an event and they say, now we've got 10 million users and we've got 20 million users and 5 million are paying. And then Deezer then obviously thought, we have to start doing that. So Deezer started doing stat brags, which were never as impressive as Spotify's stat brag. Also, Deezer suspiciously, they did a big stats brag and then they said nothing for about 2 years. And obviously, when they went for their IPO recently, we found out why.
Yeah.
Because quite a lot of the users they were declaring in their earlier statements, and I noticed this week still declaring in their press releases, are Orange customers who got Deezer as part of their package and actually are not an active user and may have never even used it at all. But anyway, Spotify and Deezer for a time were both putting out, we've got this many million users, this many million users, and RDO never put out any statements on how many users they were signing up. So that is always suspicious, and I think a lot of people assumed, that's because you haven't really got any users to be talking about. Then there was a bit of they launched video, didn't they? They launched a video version of RDO. And then they had a change of management and the new CEO came in. And then that new CEO became quite vocal and he was quite down on freemium, wasn't he? Because obviously, unlike Spotify arrived with its freemium, free with ads, £10 a month, no ads. Deezer originally was premium only, but then when they saw how far ahead Spotify was in signing people up, basically Deezer copied Spotify. RDO resisted the free level, I suspect because they couldn't afford it. It's expensive. Mm. Nobody makes money out of freemium on-demand streaming. It's expensive. It's a big loss leader. I suspect that their investors weren't willing to bankroll that. But then the new boss sort of spun that in Spotify freemium, it's never going to work long term. We've got a better model. And then, of course, when Taylor Swift then arrived dissing freemium, they could then get a bit of mileage out of that, saying, we still have Taylor Swift's content, because we have a system that she approves of.
Yeah.
Personalised radio for free and then pay for the fully on-demand experience.
And more recently, a mid-level service, which was, $3.99. Did that ever launch in Europe?
I don't think it did. It did in the US, though.
$3.99 in the US. And it was sort of, it sat somewhere between personalised radio and on-demand. More features than the first freemium level, but less than the top level premium, which we've discussed before is probably the way forward for streaming.
Yeah, so not only did RDO have arguably the best interface, they possibly had the model, which is where we're going to end up, that eventually freemium will be more of a personalised radio experience, fully on demand, £10 a month, pretty much as it is now, and then some sort of mishmash in the middle with ad-free personalised radio and some limited on-demand stuff thrown in for good measure. So arguably, RDO had the model. The problem is, while Spotify and Deezer, not to mention YouTube, are offering the free on-demand experience, it was always going to be hard for them to gain that traction and start to compete in terms of users. And we know now, because of the paperwork that has come out since this week's developments, they were hemorrhaging cash in a major, major way.
Yeah, so losing $2 million a month, they shut down with $220 million of debt, which is not a great position to be in if you've not built a user base you can hopefully make money off in the future. So they've sold some assets and some staff are transferring over to Pandora.
Who are paying what?
$75 million.
Okay. So into that $220 million hole, Pandora throwing in $75.
Yes.
That would be nice.
And Pandora, unsurprisingly, does not want that debt. So it's not taking the company as a whole. So the company itself is declaring itself bankrupt and shutting down.
Yes. So the deal was announced this week by Pandora that they were buying some of the assets and that some of the people would be transferring over for this $75 million that we mentioned. The bankruptcy was a condition of the deal that RDO then had to apply for bankruptcy protection under American bankruptcy law. In essence, wind down the company. Anthony Bay, who you mentioned, is staying with RDO. He's not going to Pandora. He will oversee the wind down. That's a fun job. Fun job, isn't it? And RDO will disappear. But crucially, although Pandora are getting some of the assets and some of the staff, they are not taking over RDO. So they're not going to run RDO as a going concern. They're not even taking RDO, the service, the experience, and just plugging it into Pandora. They are going to use the assets that they're buying at quite a high price, it has to be said. I mean, not compared to RDO's debts, but still, that's a pretty big transaction. They're going to use it for something that they themselves have planned down the line.
Yes. So it seems, well, one, it seems that they're going to add on-demand streaming to their premium service,
which they've never done before.
So it's always been personalised radio.
Pandora do have a premium service, unlike iHeartRadio, which is their main competitor in the US. They do have a premium service, so I think it's $5 a month. But all it is personalised radio, just like the free service, so limited functionality, but with no adverts, and a little bit more functionality. So I think on the free version of Pandora, you tell it what music you like, it plays you a steady stream of music. Obviously, you can't pick tracks as you go, you can't pick full albums, but you do get a certain amount of skips. So if you don't like a song, you can skip it. But on the free version, there's a limited amount of skips. I think on the $5 version, you get more skips, maybe infinite skips. I'm not quite sure. So there is a premium version of Pandora, but it is still personalized radio, and it has never really taken off. Bearing in mind that Pandora have nearly, is it 78 million? They're not getting close to 80 million active users.
Yeah.
And they're only really in the US. So they're a massive service. But the vast, vast majority of that, I mean, over 90% of those users are on the free version, not the £5 version. And so it seems to me that Pandora are saying, we want a premium business. We want a subscription revenue stream, which is basically them admitting that advertising is never going to pay for this business outright. So we need a subscription revenue stream. Clearly, we're never going to sell enough subscriptions on our current model. So we need to move into the on-demand space that RDO did. And so that is what they're going to do at some point next year. How closely it will replicate what RDO did in terms of how it looks and what you get for your money and how it's priced, who knows?
Yeah.
But that's the big development on Pandora's side.
Yeah, because it's obviously, I mean, it's a tech purchase, which is, say, as with whenever anyone buys a streaming service, it doesn't mean they're buying it so they can get the licenses, because you have to renegotiate the licenses. So it's a tech purchase. To RDO's credit, they're recognising that RDO's interface was quite nice and worked quite well, and therefore they're going to plug it into their own thing rather than build something themselves.
Yes, but I suppose, as you say, I mean, generally speaking, when people buy existing streaming services, the licences with the labels and the publishers, well, they often expire. IPO usually is allowed under the licence, but often when a transfer of ownership, licences come up for a renewal, certainly with bankruptcy, the licences will expire. I suppose the other thing is, as far as I can see, they're not even taking RDO's users. I mean, the other thing that you sometimes buy in an acquisition like this is the user base. And
well,
then you
the
transfer
problem with
them
that,
over,
obviously,
there aren't any.
Well, is there, well, one, that there aren't any. There must be some. The other problem is that RDO is an international service and Pandora currently is US only. And while Pandora also said that it's now planning international expansion, it hasn't done that yet. So a large chunk of RDO's users at this point are going to be useless to them. Also, RDO's shutting down basically now, as far as I can tell. And who knows when Pandora's slight on-demand service, however it's going to operate, will launch. So that just leaves, if you're an RDO user,
you're not going to go,
well, I might be able to listen to music again in 6 months' time, so I'll just hang around.
Yeah, and indeed. I mean, Pandora, when they put out the statement, were being quite conservative. They were sort of saying late 2016 for this sort of upgrade. So it's an interesting development, and almost more interesting from what this says about the future of Pandora than it does the fact RDO is winding down. I think quite a few people, I mean, sadly, because I think RDO was a popular service. People recognised the things that it did well. They recognise that actually its model is potentially the future. But I suspect a lot of people at the start of the year, when everyone was saying clearly all of these streaming services that existed in 2014 will not last for a whole of 2015. Sony Entertainment Network went almost immediately, rah-rah.
Oh, I didn't, really? Okay, we'll shut down now, save you some bother.
Rah-rah, then sort of, you know, slowly, 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 and then it, then the website got deleted. But I think probably audio would have been on a lot of people's lists, reluctantly, because as I say, people recognised that actually it had some good things about it. But that's not a huge surprise. But what does this tell us about Pandora? Pandora is diversifying. I think that's what this confirms. We already knew that. They bought a ticketing company a couple of months back. We were hearing that they were now starting to talk to record companies and music publishers about going beyond the US and Australia and perhaps coming back into Europe, where they could never get the licensing sorted when they had a go at that a few years back. So clearly Pandora diversifying, probably because they have to diversify. As I say, this is an admission that they cannot exist as an advertising-funded business alone. Hence, we need to really go into the premium market. We need to go into the ticketing market as well. What will that premium service look like? And as we've said before on this podcast, one of the problems is nearly all the premium services, including RDO, okay, user interface may be different, discovery tools may be different, but they are basically the same catalogue of content at the same price point. $10, £10, €10 a month. And for a mainstream audience, £120 a year is simply too much for recorded music. Pandora's 78 million people, certainly the 3 million people who are on the free version, are a mainstream audience, okay? Because they've basically been taking people away from radio more than anything else. And those people, I'm guessing here, but I would suspect the vast majority of them would never spend $10 a month on a music service alone. So really, Pandora needs to find some sort of middle service, but it won't be allowed by the labels and the publishers to offer a Spotify clone at a cheaper price point. Apple wanted to do that, and they weren't allowed. And if Apple can't get away with it, Pandora will not. But it will be interesting to see how Pandora evolves its premium service as 2016 progresses.
Although we should note, before we finish this segment, that this purchase still needs court approval as part of the bankruptcy process. So we could be back here in a couple of months' time, or maybe sooner, to say, yeah, that didn't happen.
Yeah, if someone showed up at the bankruptcy courts with 80 million, then they could gazump Pandora and the judge will ultimately have the final decision.
Not sure who's going to do that.
No, most people seem to think that it will simply be a rubber stamping process. But you're right. Important to mention that before we play the little jingle that takes us into the next story.
Jingle now! Sticking with streaming and streaming services bolting things onto themselves, although no one had to shut down this time, Spotify has announced a new thing called Fan Insights, a data service for artists and their managers.
And this segment is also going to mention Pandora. So I'm sorry if you're sick to death of us talking about Pandora. It is impossible for us to talk about Spotify's new Fan Insights service without us mentioning Pandora twice.
Yes.
So prepare yourself for that. So yes, Spotify have launched a new data service, Fan Insights, and crucially, it is aimed at artists and really their managers. So Spotify have had data services for artists and managers for a while now. They launched something a couple of years ago, at some point in the recent past.
Yeah.
Because artists and their managers do not necessarily get access to the data that Spotify is providing labels. So if you are a record company that has content on Spotify, you're getting a constant feed of data from Spotify about what music is being used, when, where, and so on and so forth. And you can make marketing decisions and other decisions based on the data that you're seeing. Plus, of course, you'll work out what money you're going to be due at the end of the month. But most artists and managers don't get access to that data because they would rely on their labels having some sort of system to share the data. And as far as I can see, most labels don't. And so to try and overcome that, Spotify Artists, which is sort of, well, I call it an outreach department. I don't know if that is right. But Spotify Artists was set up by Spotify back during the Tom York spat. See, in these days of other artists dissing Spotify, the Tom York spat all seems a bit dim and distant and a bit quaint. But when Tom York had his little rant about Spotify on Twitter, and Spotify Artists sort of followed. I'm not saying it was a direct result of that, but I think
it was an attempt to kind of more clearly explain to artists how Spotify works and how they get paid and what happens to the money when it leaves Spotify.
Yeah.
Or certainly what happens to the money while it's still at Spotify and kind of breaking down what sort of money you can expect to make depending on what level you're at in the industry.
And that was to overcome the fact that Spotify's relationships with the music business are with record companies on the recording side and publishers, or actually more often collecting societies on the publishing side. They don't have direct relationships with artists and songwriters, because actually, in terms of accessing content, they don't need direct relationships with artists and songwriters, because they get all the content in from the music rights companies. So they don't have those relationships. But then, of course, artists sometimes see their royalty statements from the label and then go on Twitter or their blog or Facebook and have a good rant about Spotify. And that's bad for Spotify. It's certainly bad for Spotify pre-IPO, pre-flotation. I'm not sure it stops anyone from subscribing to Spotify who would otherwise subscribe, but for a company that will ultimately almost certainly reach out and try and get new investors in through a stock exchange, they don't want the world thinking that all the big artists hate Spotify. And so they set up this thing called Spotify Artists, which does various things. It has a website, but it does events and various initiatives to reach out to artists and saying, yeah, this is how Spotify works, this is how the money works, these are the marketing opportunities, and so on and so forth. And actually, a lot of the stuff they do is great. And most of the other streaming services don't do that. They probably do some of it, but they don't do it at the level. They don't have the visibility, I think, that the Spotify artist team do in terms of reaching out. And part of that was offering a set of data to artists and managers, sort of replicating what the labels will see, to allow them to have an idea on how often their music's being played, where, and any other trends. So yes, That's what we already had.
Yes, and it was the data part of it was via a partnership with Next Big Sound, which was all fine and great until it hit a little snag. And this is where the mention of Pandora comes in.
Mention one.
Pandora bought Next Big Sound in May, at which point I think Spotify probably got a little bit wary of giving its data to a company owned by one of its rivals.
Yeah, so there have been three big music data startups in recent years. One was the Echo Nest, that was a little bit different, but it was an interesting music data firm that Spotify bought.
Yep.
The other was Music Metric, that Apple bought.
Yep.
Although I think that's still officially a secret. I don't think Apple have ever officially confirmed that. But Music Metric became
They did buy it, though.
The data department of Apple Music. And then Pandora bought Next Big Sound. And whenever that happens, I mean, actually, Next Big Sound initially, and I think possibly still, are saying, oh, we're still a going concern, we're offering services to whoever wants those services. But once you're owned by one of the streaming services, all the other streaming services won't want to either provide you with data, because SoundCloud cut off Next Big Sound almost as soon as the Pandora
deal
went through.
Well, the same when Spotify bought the Echo Nest, the statements of companies saying, yeah, we're not using that anymore, came quite quickly.
Yes, thick and fast. And not only will the streaming services not want to share their data with these firms once they're owned by a competitor, they won't want to buy in their services either. So it seems as soon as that deal went through, it was like, well, what is Spotify going to do? Because artists and managers like having this data. Is it just going to be turned off? And so what we know as of this week is they got busy. I suspect they were possibly already doing this, given that Next Big Sound was only sold in May and it's already launching. Although it is launching in beta, so perhaps not. Anyway, Spotify have got their own people, their own programmers busy, and they've got their own data service. So no one can buy that.
They already own it.
And screw it all up. So yes, it's their own data thing. And as far as we can see, they have been on the quiet, talking to quite a lot of managers about this. Managers love data, but
yes,
I think what a lot of managers would is there's too much of the bloody stuff. And okay, it's great having this massive feed of streaming information coming through, but how do you navigate it? And so one of the things that Spotify are claiming their new data platform will do is not only provide the data to artists and managers, but help them do something with that data.
Yeah, so specifically, I mean, it's aiming to give insights into fans, how they become fans, how they listen, where they listen, help to promote releases and tours or book tours specifically, because you can see where people are listening, so you can see where your fans are in the world. And then ultimately turn people who might start as a casual listener into a more long-term fan.
Yes, so that they will listen more and therefore generate more streaming royalties. But more than that, they will become a bigger fan and start spending money elsewhere too, through ticketing and merchandise and so on and so forth.
Yes, so Spotify said, our ultimate goal is to help artists make more informed decisions about how to establish meaningful connections with their audience.
So there you go.
That sounds like fun.
Here's the other mention of Pandora. which is, although Spotify seemed to be first to sort of grasp this idea of one way to shut up all those moaning artists about their royalties is to offer them other services, and in particular data services, Pandora followed quite quickly afterwards, which is why they've bought Next Big Sound, although they already had their Artist Something platform. It has a name. I can't remember the name, but they have a platform.
I think it's called the Artist Something platform.
I think it probably is, the ASP. And so they launched that a while back. So they are also providing data to artists and managers. The Next Big Sound purchase was a big part of that. And of course, we know Pandora have moved into ticketing. And so Pandora are hoping that one thing that they can say to artists is, OK, we might not be able to pay you the level of royalties that you want, but look, we've got data, we've got a marketing channel, we can even do the transaction of the ticketing for you. We'll help you learn about, market to, and sell tickets to your fan base on our network. So Pandora are doing this as well. And I can see that both Pandora and Spotify in the coming couple of years will probably, in terms of a B2B side, start competing on this. Our data services are better than their data services. We can help you market your fans. In fact, I think they've both put out pretty similar statements in the last couple of weeks about how they are the biggest platforms of fan engagement and knowledge, or some nonsense marketing words put in an order that vaguely makes sense.
Yeah, because obviously, as well as wanting to placate artists, they also want more listeners. And if you placate artists in a way that makes artists engage with your platform and then try to get more listeners on your platform, you have more listeners. And that's a good thing, because everyone needs more listeners.
Well, I suppose the interesting distinction between what Pandora are doing and what Spotify is doing is, I think Spotify to date, it is exactly that. It's about placating artists, getting them on board, having artists, you know, bigging up Spotify more. Whereas clearly for Pandora, although there's all of that as well, they also potentially see other revenue streams coming out of this. If we can help artists sell more tickets, well, perhaps we can take a cut of the ticket money. If we can help them sell more merch, perhaps we can take a cut of the merch. Whereas to date, Spotify have not shown any interest in that. They are in the subscriptions business. That is what they're interested in. But if they can help artists do other stuff, and in doing so, not have too many artists saying, we want more money, we want more money, then that allows Spotify to achieve what it wants to achieve. And of course, not only are Spotify and Pandora likely to start competing more in terms of the services that they can offer artists in the coming year, given everything we said in the first bit about Pandora's ambitions of 2016, both in terms of expanding globally and moving more into the on-demand space, Pandora and Spotify, which have not really been head-on competitors to date, I mean, perhaps they have in the US market, but they're not full-on competitors worldwide. Perhaps by the end of 2016, they will be full-on competitors, both in terms of reach and the services they're offering. So I think we've not, in the past, generally thought about the Spotify-Pandora competition in that way. We are now thinking about it behind the scenes, and I think moving forward, they could become two big head-on competitors for consumers as well. So interesting to watch how this all develops.
Check back with us in a year's time. We'll see how that's all gone.
Spotify Artist Data, whatever it's called. What's it called? Spotify
Fan Insights.
Fan Insights. It's still in beta, but apparently any managers who want to dabble just have to get in touch. We just have to ask. And then lazy managers who can't be bothered asking will get it added to their current sort of management accounts down the line at some point. Time for the CMU approved bit now, as it is popularly known.
You really built that up.
Amongst our listeners. So this is where Andy Malt tells you about the music and the artists he has been approving this week in the CMU Daily. Artists like Sudakistan.
Yes, very much like them, in that they are one of the artists who I featured in the approved column this week.
So tell us why.
They are a... well, this isn't why. You've set me up for a fall already.
Tell us who they are.
Good, that's better. They are a Stockholm-based garage rock band heavily influenced by the South American roots of four-fifths of its members.
Tell us about their sound.
Well, as what I just said would suggest, it's basically garage rock with some cool percussion on it, which makes it sound very different to what is a very well-worn sound. Let's not make any mistake about it. So, yeah, it's cool. They've got a debut album coming out this week. So,
which is why you're approving.
Like now.
You finally got to answering my initial question.
You can listen to this now. It's called Caballo Negro. It's good. Listen to it.
Aidan Knight was next.
Aidan Knight, he is a Canadian and he has been releasing music for quite some time, although his debut UK album, Each Other, is coming out on Full Time Hobby on the 22nd of January next year.
But there's something to listen to now, because that's quite a long time away.
It's quite a long time away. There's a few things. Well, you can go on Bandcamp and you can listen to the whole album now if you want. There's a couple of singles, though. He's released a video for All Clear, which is, that's a very good song. Has some very good hi-hat action on it, as I noted in the approved article. There's also The Arp. That's another track that he's like just put out on SoundCloud for you to listen to.
Lawrence Taylor.
Lawrence Taylor is apparently some hotly tipped young tearaway.
Hotly tipped now, because he's been in the CD
approved
column.
Hotly tipped by me.
Yeah. That's how hotly tipped. Well, not just tipped, hotly tipped.
As with many hotly tipped people, I initially thought, yeah, not so keen. But that was for the first 12 seconds of this song, Bang Bang, from his recently released debut EP, Bang Bang. It starts with this sort of, you know, kind of gently strummed guitar. I thought, oh, it's going to be a bit singer-songwriter-y. And then his voice kicks in, 12 seconds in, boom, bang, bang, what a voice. Went a bit Alan Partridge there. that's all I have to say.
That's all you have to say about
Lawrence
Taylor.
I can't improve on that.
And his track, Bang, Bang. Julia Holter, who fortunately, her song's called Silhouette. I don't think you can have a cheesy line involving the word silhouette.
I can give it a go.
Go on then.
I don't know. Julia Holter's very good, isn't she? I really like Julia Holter, and I realise that I have not really written about her new album that much. I think possibly because I was having a conversation with someone earlier this week and they recommended me an album and I went and listened to it and then they said, did you like it? And I said, well, yes, but I think I need to listen to it a few more times to really take it in before I properly form an opinion. And I think that is possibly not the downfall, but it's a problem for people who make really good albums. And like Julia Holter as well, she makes albums that you feel like, oh, I need to listen to this five times before I even think about saying anything about it.
And by that time, you've
forgotten
about it.
By that time, the moment's passed. It's all gone. So we got to November, and I realised I've not really written anything about this. And then she released this new video, and I thought, well, I better talk it up now, because it's a really, really good album. All her albums are really good, but I think this is up there at the top of the list. Maybe not right at the top, but certainly top three, let's
yes.
say. How about that?
Casting a silhouette.
Have You in My Wilderness
two.
Is the album's title. Also, she's very good live and she's going to be touring the UK in February. So that's lots of things to be excited about.
But you're not attempting a cheesy end line.
You were right. Silhouette doesn't lend itself
with
to
the word
to
silhouette.
The quality of the last
one. Well, I'm glad to hear it. So that is this week's CMU Approved. CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved for more information if you wish.
We've talked digital music a lot already. Let's move over to live and the secondary ticketing market, which I don't know if we've ever discussed in any great detail on
the
podcast.
We certainly haven't since the podcast returned. We may have done in the old podcast, in the V1 podcast, but somehow...
One day you're going to stop saying that in every single podcast.
Alluding to the big gap.
Oh, yeah. Well, do you know we used to do a podcast?
The big embarrassing gap. But somehow we've managed to do a weekly podcast since June without ever discussing ticket touting. I don't quite know how that has happened, but talking about it now, there is a premise. There's a reason why ticket touting is newsworthy this week, even though nearly everything we're going to say has nothing to do with this week, and we could have said 4 years ago. But why is it newsworthy this week?
Well, the government is running yet another review of the secondary ticketing market. It's relevant this week because today, as this podcast goes out, the 20th of November, the public consultation bit of that review closes. So if you haven't got your submission in yet, you might want to hurry it along.
We're assuming that the whichever department of government is doing this, I don't even know.
It is the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, I believe.
You believe? We are assuming they subscribe to the podcast. So therefore, yeah, Everything we're about to say is our submission to that review, and then we don't have to write it down. That's our assumption.
Right.
So,
yeah.
as we all know, secondary ticketing, or let's call it, you know, online ticket touting, because we know that all the secondary ticketing sites hate it
when, touts.
We refer to them as online industrial touts. So we shall refer to them as evil touts as often as we can in this segment of the podcast, because the guys at StubHub and SeatWave and Get Me In and Viagogo will love that.
Okay.
There's also a lobbying organisation for the touting.
The Association of Evil Touts.
Yeah, something like that. Who said that I got the wrong end of the stick because I referred to them as a pro-touting organisation. And I said, oh, any reseller ticket, as far as I'm concerned, is touting. Ticket touting ain't new, of course. There have always been ticket touts. But what the internet allowed was mass touting of tickets, not just outside a venue on a wet, damp night in central London, but via initially eBay. It all began on eBay. And then these standalone sites launched, which were focused exclusively on the resale of tickets. StubHub is one of them, which is owned by eBay. That's why eBay stopped you from selling tickets on eBay itself. Not because they were concerned about touting, but because they'd bought an entire separate business. Then there's Viagogo. And then there is SeatWave and Get Me In, I think, are the other big two in the UK, both of which are owned by Ticketmaster.
Because they're very Moorish. You can't just have one.
Yes, you can't just have one ticketing company. So Ticketmaster, obviously one of the biggest primary ticket sellers in the world, but they are also in the secondary ticketing business. And it has been controversial ever since this first started to gain momentum. 10 years ago, we've been writing about this. And actually, the story hasn't changed much. 10 years ago, there was this bizarre couple of years where the government kept saying, and that was the Labour government at the time, the government kept saying to the live industry, oh, this rise in touting and the fact that tickets are on sale, you know, 10 times their face value online and fans can't get primary tickets and they're having to buy these overpriced secondary tickets. This is a scandal. Hey, live industry, sort this out. And then the live industry would say, there's nothing we can do about it. And actually, we hate all of these touts. Hey, government, sort it out. And the government would say, no, this is your problem. And it went backwards and forwards. And then it turned out that neither did anything about it. So touting carried on, the market grew. And actually, what you started to see was within the management community and within the live community, well, those communities sort of split between those who continue to be quite vigilante, this is evil, it must be stopped. Harvey Goldsmith, legendary concert promoter, is particularly vocal on this and was quoted again this week.
He called secondary ticketing sites a national disgrace.
Even though it's a global phenomenon, so I'm not quite sure why it's specifically a national disgrace for us here in the UK. So there are some in the live sector and in the management sector who remain, this is bad, it's bad for fans. Obviously, there's that whole thing that the secondary sites present themselves as if, you know, oh, well, on our site, there are thousands and thousands of people who just happened to buy a ticket for a gig and now they can't go.
So they thought they'd sell it for $3,000.
Yeah, something's come up and now they can't go. And of course, the people who are against this in the live community, management community, saying, OK, there might be a handful of people who genuinely bought a ticket, now can't go, and they're trying to resell it, get their money back. But mainly there are industrial touts on here. There are people who have built businesses around this. One of the allegations is that some of the secondary sites have secret sister companies that are themselves in the touting game. So although the secondary sites are very much, we're just the middleman website, we're not actually involved in the touting, the conspiracy theory is that at least some of them are. But also, I said that half of the live community and half of the management community continue to be down and vocal on touting. The other half of both of those communities have sort of adopted what would be called a, if you can't beat them, join them approach.
Yeah, so it is the case that a lot of people who are selling secondary tickets at inflated prices are the artists and promoters themselves. And that's why I think a lot of tickets can go on sale quite so quickly on these sites because, there was that Katy Perry rider that leaked two or three years ago now, in which one of the things stipulated on her rider was Katy Perry will be given, like, a certain number of tickets for each show so that she can sell them at an inflated price.
Yeah, and then there was that Dispatches documentary which had two or three UK tours where the promoters were doing the same. They were saying, OK, we'll put this many tickets on the primary sites and we'll, you know, immediately put this many tickets on the secondary sites at a markup. And what the promoters and the agents and the managers who are in the touting game say, well, they say two things. First of all, they say, we can't beat them, join them. We would rather there was no touting, but that's clearly not going to happen. And so, well, and this is the other thing they say, surely it's better that if anyone is going to get a markup, if a 50 quid ticket's going to sell for a grand, surely it's better that the 950 quid, what they actually normally say is, the fan would prefer it, that the 950 quid didn't just go to some random guy. It went to the artist and the promoter and the people who are making the show so they can make the show better.
Yeah, maybe. Although you could also quite easily counter that with saying, wouldn't it be better for the fan if you flooded the secondary ticketing sites with face value tickets so that the inflated ones don't sell?
So that they don't sell. It's a good point. Good point there made.
Take note, government.
The other thing I would say is, perhaps those promoters are right to an extent. You know, OK, we provide two ticketing services. If you're willing to be there at 9 a.m. on Friday morning when the tickets go on sale and do the refresh thing, then you get it at this price. And if you're lazy and you're not willing
you'll
to do
pay
that,
the laziness tax.
Then you come in 2 weeks before the gig and you go onto a Viagogo or a Seatwave and you pay a significant markup. But the markup goes to the promoter and the artist, and that's all fine. Except the vast majority of promoters and agents and managers who do this do so anonymously.
Yes.
Which I think, you know, if you're going for the, well, we have two services, primary and then secondary for people who come in last minute, and that's a legitimate system, well, it probably is a legitimate system. But then don't do it secretly. Resell the tickets as the artist, as the promoter, as the venue or whatever. So the fact that so many people do it anonymously, I think, does make the whole thing seem a little bit shady.
Yeah, and that's one of the big criticisms that's still going on, because there has been some legislation on this. The Consumer Rights Act came in at the end of the last parliament. It had some new regulations for secondary ticketing sites, but didn't go as far as forcing people to be identified on sites. Part of the reason that sellers particularly wouldn't want that is because if your name is revealed on the ticket that you're trying to sell, the promoter, if it's not the promoter themselves selling it, can cancel your ticket, because it's against the terms and conditions of the ticket to resell it.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, as you say, although for years and years and years there was a lot of debate about this, and this has really been an issue that has been a big debating point, and then no one talked about it for 2 years, and a big debating point, and no one talked about it for 2 years. But when the Consumer Rights Act was going through Parliament earlier this year, originally secondary ticketing was not part of that legislation. It wasn't the government, the coalition government, as was then in power. It was Parliament. There were some MPs in Parliament who tried to add a load of regulations into it as the Act moved through Parliament to regulate. Initially, when it went to the Commons, where the government generally has the majority, so gets their way, they voted those down, so a compromise was made. So a handful of secondary ticketing regulations did end up in the Consumer Rights Act, but as you say, the biggies didn't. You know, but the two big things that could really make a difference are if you force the seller to A, reveal their identity, and B, to reveal the precise number of the ticket. And if you reveal that information, as you say, under the vast majority of tickets, the terms and conditions say that you can't resell the ticket.
Yes, because they were actually, one of the regulations they wanted was you had to name the seat number. I think it's come down to you have to name the block it is. You have to give a rough idea of where it is.
But yes, if
exactly,
it's a venue
because
where,
if you knew exactly which seat it was, again, it could be cancelled.
And I think, you know, promoters can cancel. And this is one of the interesting debates. There are some people who say, well, ticket touting is fine and it's fair because you've bought a product and then you resell it. You know, if I buy a telly and I decide I don't want the telly, I can sell it. That's just the way the world works. And so that's what the pro ticket touting people say. It's fair game. Buy products, sell them on. That's the way the world works. But the comeback is, well, actually, a ticket isn't a product. It's a contract. A ticket is a contract between the promoter and the ticket buyer. In return for some money, I will let you into this room when this band plays at this time. T's and C's say, cannot be transferred. The minute you transfer, breach of contract, cancel the ticket. If I know the resale has happened. And there are some promoters who do cancel tickets that they know have been resold. But the problem with that is, A, it's quite a lot of work to work out that they have been resold. But then, even once you've worked it out and you've cancelled the ticket, some poor person has to be the person on the door at the venue when the fan shows up, the fan who's paid way more than every other fan to see the artist play. Someone has to be the person that says, sorry, you're not getting in tonight. And so unless cancelling of touted tickets became so common that all music consumers became aware, oh, it's dangerous to buy tickets that have been touted because there's a very high chance a ticket will get cancelled. Unless it becomes the norm, then actually, even if promoters could work out a ticket's being resold and cancel it, a lot won't. They don't want to go down that route.
The other thing there would be, as well as punters knowing that your ticket might be cancelled if you were using a secondary ticketing site, they'd have to know that they were using a secondary site in the first place. And there was a Which report that came out recently that found that quite a lot of people don't realise that there's any difference between going to Ticketmaster and Seatwave.
And I think there's two things there. One thing that the Which report specifically said is the fact that Ticketmaster own two of the sites, yeah, and therefore their logo is down in the footer.
So it looks official.
Then
people
don't understand. Also, I mean, I know there have been, I think it's more anecdotal research in the past that says most primary ticketing websites are such a nightmare to use, and you get that commission whammed on the final screen. These days, they're meant to tell you what the commission is when you start. But people are used to the ticket buying experience being painful and then extra fees suddenly being added at the end. So therefore, because primary ticketing is a bit of a nightmare, people don't think, oh, hang on a second, this website's a bit complicated to use. Where are all these extra fees coming in? Oh, it must be a secondary site.
Also, there was, I mean, Harvey Goldsmith was, Harvey Goldsmith's example for ridiculous prices on secondary tickets was a recent run of shows at the O2 by U2. And he was saying, you know, some of these tickets were being sold for as much as £3,000. But on the primary sites, they were being sold for £182. So prices already look ridiculous. So, you know, who knows what a normal ticketing price is?
As we say, the government is currently reviewing this. They are obliged to review it because in the Consumer Rights Act that we mentioned earlier, as well as passing a handful of relatively light regulations onto the secondary market, there was a line that said, and once this has all gone through, the government must then review the whole thing anew, and so that is what they are currently doing. I suppose we should give the other side of the argument what the secondary ticketing sites say, not least because I think they're probably going to win the argument here. Even though a lot of people in the last week or so in the music community, managers, artists, promoters, venue owners, festival people, the Association of Independent Festivals are quite vocal on this, have been rallying, saying, you know, something must be done. Prince even joined the debate last week. Normally, he's dissing digital music services. It's good to see him dissing ticketing services.
It's actually in the wake of the Paris attacks, his whole tour has been cancelled anyway. However, when tickets initially went on sale and straight away started turning up on secondary ticketing sites, he was not happy and just suspended sales. So you weren't able to buy tickets anymore. And they were, I don't know exactly how they were planning to get around it, but I think they were trying to find a way of selling tickets without them, you know, being resold.
Which, I mean, obviously, Glastonbury have almost cracked it. So I mean, that if you're really keen and you're willing to do the photo ID system, which Glastonbury does, then there is a way around it. But that's a massive pain even for a festival, let alone just a normal tour.
The other option is, which some bands have done, Radiohead did a while ago. Is you link it to the credit card. You can't get into the show unless you have the credit card that the ticket was bought with. But then the problem there is that what if, you know, one of the examples of people falling foul of this was like your mum buys you the ticket for your birthday and then you can't get in because your mum's not coming to the gig with you. Or you buy a ticket for you and three of your mates and then you're ill the day of the show. That means if you can't go, your three mates can't go either.
Yeah, so that was Radiohead trying to be the... I mean, you know, they've been very vocal on this throughout, trying to do the right thing, but actually it just caused more problems than had the tickets been on the secondary market. So a lot of people in music have been very vocal about this in the run-up to the deadline of this. Having said that, I have to say, I don't see a Conservative government doing anything about this.
Sajid Javid, the former culture minister, came out quite pro secondary ticketing and sort of saw it as plucky entrepreneurs using the free market for their own benefit.
And the argument that the secondary sides always put forward is this argument: if you over-regulate and you force people to reveal their identity, to reveal the exact ticket number when they resell, all that will happen is that all of the touts will go and take their touting to websites outside the jurisdiction of the UK courts. There are plenty of sites in Eastern Europe who will take up the touting slack if you make it that, in essence, no touts will want to use a Seatwave or a Viagogo. And once you go outside the jurisdiction of the UK, at least with the secondary sites that we have, there are some consumer rights protections. So, for example, if you are sold a fraudulent ticket, That is to say, a ticket that doesn't exist.
Which does happen, which although Ticketmaster...
insists it doesn't happen that often.
Say it's very rare.
But what they also say is, if it does happen, we will refund the money. And, I mean, actually, somebody, I can't remember who it was, I think it was Association of Independent Festivals, was saying, yes, they will ultimately refund you the money, but on the night when you're not getting into the show, it's still really annoying. But
you can't get hold of them at that exact point.
But all of that said, the sites say, we offer a certain amount of consumer rights protection that you wouldn't get outside of the UK, certainly wouldn't get beyond the European Union. Better it be within our system than elsewhere. And so over-regulate, you'll send it all underground. Having said that, if it is true that most of the touting is being done by sister companies to the second ticketing site, which is an allegation, and the promoters and the managers who've gone for the Can't Beat It join them, would they go and start doing it on some random auction site in Russia? I don't know. So perhaps that's a false threat. But certainly that is what the secondary ticketing sector says. And it's interesting, isn't it? Ticketmaster, Live Nation is in a weird position with all of this. Obviously, Live Nation, big management company, big venue owner, big promoter, Ticketmaster owner. And Live Nation at the top has always been a little bit ambiguous on what its opinion is. Because I think throughout the Live Nation family, there's a real mixture of opinions. But you do have Ticketmaster, who, if they were just primary sellers, and there are other primary seller ticketing companies who are very down on the touts and talk out against it, but your biggest primary seller in the UK is a massive fan of secondary ticketing and lobbies hard to keep the regulation down. So I suspect that there won't be any major new regulations, certainly under the current government. But, you know, perhaps I will be pleasantly proved wrong. We'll see.
We'll see. And, you know, there'll probably be another review in 2 years anyway.
So we'll get Matt to keep this segment. Because, as I say, nearly everything we've said in this segment, other than the Consumer Rights Act bit, we could have said 5 years ago. So let's store this bit and we'll just rerun it next time the government do a review.
Just time to quickly run through a few of the things that didn't make the cut for further discussion this week. Top of this list this week, I should mention that Dan Lesac has written another column for us, this time looking at subscription models, different to your streaming subscription. More like, I think we mentioned before, Bandcamp launched subscriptions to artists. So you pay £20 a year and then you get access to everything an artist puts out in that time. Dan was questioning whether that's actually good value for money.
Yeah, his starting point was, that's a great idea, but will it work? Is that too much to ask? Etc., etc. It's a great article. People are already debating it online, so go read it on the site.
SFX, we've already discussed. This is a thing we have discussed at length on the podcast before. Robert Silliman's planned buyback of SFX. Turns out all that discussion is a big waste of time because he's decided he's not doing it.
Yeah, so Robert FX Silliman has now said he doesn't want to buy all the shares in his company.
He's noticed the share price.
That he doesn't currently control. Yeah, in the latest, I mean, obviously, long, long, long story, in the most recent bid he made, he was making a $3.25 bid per share. It wasn't all in cash up front. It was some cash up front and some down the line. Bit complicated. But it was $3.25. As we entered the studio, the SFX share price was below 50 cents. So 41 cents, I think, all-time low since SFX floated back in 2013.
Yes, I mean, the problem, yeah, his original bid ended up looking very generous as the share price dropped. And now his
revised lower bid is also looking a bit too generous.
So, yeah, he's kind of said, let's just cancel all this and focus on making the company profitable again.
Yes, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation already in recent weeks about SFX financial situation, a talk of bankruptcy looming. This is only going to add to that speculation. Yeah. So we may be coming back to SFX next week. We'll see.
Adele has an album out today as the podcast goes out, although you may already have heard a good chunk of it because, oh, this is like, I feel bad making light of this because the point at which Juno realised this has happened must have been awful. Juno Records put their product page online.
Juno being a download store.
An online retailer. So yes. Physical products as well.
Of course.
Not just download and DJ equipment. Good store. I've used it for stuff. Anyway, they put it online. Fortunately, as they put it live, they also put 2 minute samples of every single track on the album live in their product page. And that's fine. It wasn't online for very long. They took it down very quickly. Unfortunately, most of people on the internet had noticed by the time it came down. And so that was bad. Of all the albums to do that with, oh, that's not good.
Although, on one level, so what? why does it matter? But yes, a little bit embarrassing given all of the hype around the Adele album.
Hey, if you thought it was stupid that Australia were in Eurovision this year, you're going to love next year when Australia are back. It was supposed to be a one-off for the 60th anniversary, but Australia came fifth, so they're being allowed back in.
Also, Eurovision, in announcing this, went further than last year's statement in sort of almost saying, perhaps we could be a worldwide song contest.
Yeah, which is, you're called Eurovision.
Yes.
The clue is in the name.
So we'll be interested to see
Global Vision Song Contest is not a good name.
What other countries?
World Vision's already a thing, isn't it?
Before the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Eastern Europe had its own competitor to Eurovision. I can't remember what it was called. So Eastern Europe and Russia had a song contest. And I don't know if this is true, but this is what I've always been told. Back in the 80s or whenever it happened, rather than having phone voting, they did a thing where people were told, if you want to vote for this artist, turn all your lights off now. And then I don't know if they had a satellite or if they did it based on electricity usage, but that was how they worked out what people were voting for. They were told, turn all your lights off now, turn all your lights on now. And that's how they did the voting. So perhaps if Eurovision wants to go beyond its original territory, then they should look into quirky voting systems. There wouldn't be any more useless voting systems than the ones they've had in recent years.
I suppose not. And Sandy Tom, this was something that had happened that we decided not to discuss on last week's podcast because I ended up writing a long Beef of the Week.
Very long Beef of the Week.
Very long. I don't know how I got something that
I long. Have to say, I cried several times having to proof it, so quite apt.
Anyway, she posted a video on YouTube crying because she had not been playlisted by Radio 2, and this was apparently vital to the success of her new single, which was perfect for Radio 2. Her words, and then she deleted that video. But, you know, as we know with the Adele leak, doesn't have to be up very long. Everyone's seen it.
So, yeah, a lot of people talking, split opinion as to whether or not actually this was a singer-songwriter who had been so hyped a few years ago, spent 2 or 3 years, everyone saying, you're it, big, big, big. Then she got dropped, her career has sort of been on the wane, and the frustration of being in that position, and that was totally fair. Other people saying, you had your 50 minutes of fame, stop your moaning. What makes you think you should get playlisted by Radio 2? So yeah. a split of opinion.
To be fair, you only need to listen to the song to realise why they didn't playlist it.
So poor Sandy Tom, but she's put a new video online since, which is not crying, it's not moaning, it's just for you to go and enjoy and watch.
I wouldn't say it was enjoyable.
Well, you can definitely watch it.
You can definitely watch it. Talking about things that aren't enjoyable, Morrissey's been nominated for a Bad Sex in Fiction Award.
Relating to his book.
Yes.
Does everyone remember that Morrissey wrote out, not an autobiography, a work of fiction?
Yes. Every time I go and check this, it doesn't seem like it can be true, but apparently it's a novel about a demonically possessed sports relay team. It has what has been widely discussed as a really terrible sex scene in it, in which he uses the term bulbous salutation, and there's a lot more where that came from. He recently said in an interview that the only reason his book's been criticised is because the critics don't like him personally. It has nothing to do with the book. But he did use the term bulbous salutation.
You know, after all the bad reviews, by the end of next month, he could be able to put award-winning on the front on the front of his book.
So, true.
Silver lining to every story.
You can find links to all these stories that we haven't discussed and learn more about them in the show notes to this podcast here at completemusicupdate.com.
Now, Zayn Malik,
who we are now going to talk about, he's back.
He is back as a solo artist, sort of stealing the thunder, because obviously One Direction's album came out last week. Was it last week? Was last week
yeah.
the Bieber One Direction head-to-head?
Yeah.
So One Direction are in the news with their new album. But Zayn Malik is also talking about his solo work, and most of what we're going to talk about now stems from one interview.
Yeah, so he did the cover interview for this month's Fader magazine. And it's quite a detailed interview. It's quite an interesting interview. It lifts the lid on some behind-the-scenes stuff about One Direction and behind the scenes of the industry side of the band, also their relationship with fans. Various interesting insights, like fans often take to ringing his doorbell in the middle of the night because they think that if he's sleepy when he comes to the door, he might accidentally start a conversation with them and maybe invite them in because he's too tired to realise that that's a bad idea. He also talked about the certain section of fans' conspiracy theory that Louis and Harry are in a relationship together.
Which we, I think we've reported on the CMU, possibly
before,
in the form of a beef at some point.
I think so, yes. We've certainly written about it
because
before.
There are rivalries between different factions of the fan base based on which conspiracy theories you do or do not believe about the band members being in relationship.
But he's, so Zane said actually the Harry and Louis find that quite difficult because it really affects then how they act around each other in public. But then, of course, the fans would say, well, that's part of the conspiracy theory. In fact, this is noted in the interview that the, you know, the fans will read that and say, well, he's been paid off by the management to pretend that they're not in a relationship.
But if he has been paid off by management, they didn't pay him off to not say some dissing stuff about the band and his time in it and the music that they were putting out.
Yeah, I mean, he said that he wanted to go home. Those are his words. Wanted to go home from the beginning. But he stuck it out for 5 years because he was kind of in it then. And then it's a whirlwind. I'd imagine that the 5 years probably passed quite quickly because it really, you know, has been quite an intense whirlwind of a short career.
And one would imagine every time he logged onto internet banking, there was a reason to stay in.
Yeah, he's got a very nice house in North London. And that's a reason to stay. But one day in March, he woke up and went, do you know what? I know we're finishing this soon, but I can't make it to the end. I'm just going to go home.
And he wasn't very happy about his vocals on quite a few of the songs. Felt that the management, well, not management, label, I guess, the powers that be were always forcing the most sort of mediocre, non-interesting performance they could get out of him.
Yeah, he was kind of saying that, you know, the members of the band get writing credits on One Direction songs, but usually it's sort of tweaking here and there on songs that come to them kind of fully formed, pretty much.
Which we pretty much knew, but it's interesting to have him confirming that.
But it was interesting, but he was saying like his solo stuff, he's been writing solo stuff for quite a long time as a means of therapy to take his mind off what an awful time he was having in One Direction. But he was saying that, you know, he would occasionally try to put some of his own style into his vocal recordings.
For One Direction.
For One Direction, do a bit more kind of R&B style. And any time he did that, he'd just be made to re-record it over and over again. He was saying like 50 times until they got a take where he just did, his words, generic as fuck, pop version of the vocal, and they'd use that one.
That's what they should call the greatest hits album.
Generic as fuck.
Presuming we were getting a One Direction greatest hits album.
Well, I think we've mentioned before, they still owe an album under their contract, which presumably will be a greatest hit. So yeah, that's
perfect.
That's
name.
The title sorted.
Yeah. Well done, Zayn. He was actually in the room to talk about his solo work rather than his One Direction experiences. He did talk a little bit about what we can expect.
Yep, so he's working with producer Malay, who did Frank Ocean's first album and also I think is working with Frank Ocean on his second album. So a credible R&B producer. And there is a little, there's a video that goes with this interview on the Fader website, which you get a little snippet of instrumental music from the album, which I don't know, sounds promising. I'm interested to hear Zane's solo work. He also said, it revealed that there was a lot of unconventional recording. And this, they reckoned about 30% of the time they actually recorded in a proper recording studio. A chunk of it they recorded while camping in the woods, which is apparently where Zane got into archery. So Zane's into archery now. There's a lot of talk in the interview about his crossbow that he has at his house.
It's good to know. He does also talk about some musical inspiration for these new tracks.
Yeah, we mentioned, you know, him trying to put kind of an R&B slant onto his vocals and being shot down. And he's obviously working with Frank Ocean. His stuff is going to be very R&B. And he talked about his influence being, well, it's in the video where he actually says this line. His influences are from when he was growing up, listened to his dad's old records like 90s R&B, which is the most depressing sentence that those could be considered some old records that you found. So I think it's going to be very different to One Direction. And I mean, it's probably, I assume it would be more focused. So I think part of the problem with One Direction is that they're a group of, well, they're now four. They were five very different individuals. They were just thrown together.
Yeah,
you know,
because they all entered.
They all
solo
entered,
artists.
They entered the X Factor solo artists. They've all been thrown together as a group. They all have, as much as, you know, Zane's saying they don't get to put any of their style on it, they are all very different from each other. And their music does pull in a lot of different directions. I think that's a criticism of the new album, is that it's all over the place. because it's sort of, I guess partly it's trying to set all of them up who remain, the remaining four, for their solo careers.
And also that might be a sign that as the albums have gone on, they have been given a little bit more control over the music. But as a result of that, yeah, as you say, they each use their control to go in a different direction rather than one direction.
Yes. They should stay in one direction. No, they're pulling off in all over the place. It's all a disaster. That's why they have to split up.
So, Zayn Malik interviewed in Fader magazine, and whereas the other week you were bigging up the Bieber interview because it was hilarious but not intentionally so.
Yeah.
Actually, it sounds like an interesting read for what he says.
I would recommend it. It's an interesting interview with someone who's clearly thought quite a lot. I think genuinely he spent a lot of his time in One Direction thinking about his place in the world and what's happened to him. So he has a lot of interesting insights into what it is to be a pop star.
So go read that interview. In fact, you can go and read it right now because this podcast is over.
This is it. We're finished. Oh, how excited are you about Zayn's solo album? Why don't you let us know on at CMU, on Twitter. You could also tell us if you're more excited about a different member of One Direction's solo output. I'm not sure why you would be. Tell us which one, or don't bother. But whatever you do, do hit subscribe on this podcast so you can get it automatically next week. Thank you very much. I'm Andy Malt. Chris Cook presented this podcast with me. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
I'm now quite worried about what's going to be on the end of this week's podcast. There's a lot of incriminating stuff could go in.